I'm Nikki Kristoff, and welcome to Teched Up. On today's episode, cyber defense expert Matteo Tomasini joins remotely from Brooklyn to help demystify the deep and dark web. We talk browsers, VPNs, mirror sites, and it wouldn't be summer 2023 if we didn't touch on AI. Matteo has an interesting take on both the good and the bad of the 5% of the internet that most of us don't ever visit. Today's guest joining me remotely is Matteo Tomasini. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You and I were sitting next to each other at a dinner, and I was like, what are you doing for a living? And you were talking about the dark web, and then you were talking about the deep web. And I was thinking, I don't totally understand how this all works. And if I don't understand it, nobody understands. And as I am wont to do, I dragged you onto this podcast. So I appreciate you taking the time to help me and help other people understand how this is all structured and what it means.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm happy to be here.
So maybe we just start with the concept of like the surface web, what we all use, what the deep web is, and what the dark web is, just kind of in layman's terms and how you would describe it to someone.
Sure, absolutely. So yeah, like as you kind of already mentioned, the internet can be kind of divided into three strata or layers. There's the surface web, the deep web, and the dark web. The surface web would be basically everything that has been indexed by major search engines. So Google, Bing, Yahoo, whatever it is. So when you go to google.com, you type in a query, it returns results. And because those results have been indexed, because those results are on the surface web, you can see them, you can view them. The deep web is kind of one level below that. So that's really where you need to make a jump to get to that data. So it might be data that's in a database, like vehicle records online, or even political contributions, password protected databases, like Westlaw, which helps you look up litigation, or really anything like that. Then kind of one level below that is kind of the dark web. And the dark web is a relatively small percentage of the internet, maybe 5 to 7% at any one time. And the dark web is basically a part of the internet that requires specialized software to access. There are multiple dark nets within the dark web. So there's different services that run on the dark web that you can access. The most popular one is Tor, but I can kind of stop there and see if you have any questions.
Okay, so far. Yeah. I do have questions. Okay, so yeah. Backing up, when I started, said the surface web, but then I've heard people call it ClearNet, or like, am I saying that right?
Yeah, it's interchangeable. It really okay. is. And a lot of these definitions are pretty loose. Like even darknet versus dark web, people say, oh, there's the dark web, which includes different darknets.
So the ClearNet, the surface web is anything basically that you can Google and you see the results. So
yeah.
Like the Financial Times landing page is on the surface web, but you have to go behind a paywall to get to their articles. So you can't just search that and find it. Is that sort of the difference between surface and deep web?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So you would need to have like kind of something in between you getting to that result. Google has been proactively indexing more and more and more of the internet. So like the deep web is technically kind of shrinking just because a lot has been indexed now.
Okay. Oh, I remember actually when I worked at Google, that was not the case. You had to literally go to Twitter and then search within Twitter to find tweets. They weren't indexed by Google.
Yeah, that's still going to be the case most of the time. But like Google and other search engines have been indexing more and more of them. So if you type in search for Twitter and then you say, I want to search for certain tweets, you're not going to get all of them because obviously they don't have the entire Twitter index, especially now Musk isn't going to give it to them, but you could find some tweets that mention maybe news articles or posts or certain things that have been shared a million times and to the extent that they've risen to the level of being indexed by Google. But for the most part, if you're going to want to search a kind of unique database, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, court records, vehicle numbers, vehicle identification numbers, political contributions, you're going to want to go to that database to do that search. And because you have to go to that database, it's technically the deep web.
Okay, got it. One thing I've read before we started chatting today is that the percentage of things that are indexed on the surface web is like actually pretty small of the whole internet. Is that true?
Yeah. Most is going to be on that deep web. Like there is just so much out there because you have to consider, A, there are these kind of databases that are behind paywalls or you need credentials to log in to get to them. There's also going to be kind of ephemeral websites, things that are only up for like a day or two. So those are sites that Google or Bing or whoever is going to be able to index in the first place.
Oh, I never thought about ephemeral sites. I like that. Okay. So then the dark web is kind of part of the deep web? It's like because it's not easily accessible, or is that inaccurate?
Yeah, technically, it's like a different level. Like technically, it's deep web in so much as it's unindexed. It's not properly indexed by these major search engines. There are small little dark web Googles kind of that try to index a lot of the deep web. There's a search engine called Torch, for example, that tries to collect as much data from the dark web so that they can then, so it's then searchable by their users. But no, for the most part, like the key difference is that you can get to the deep web from Firefox, Chrome, Brave, whatever browser you use. You just type in a query, you do one jump, you get to that database, and then you do your search, boom, you're in the deep web. The dark web, you can't do that. The dark web, depending on which darknet inside the dark web you want to access, you have to use a specialized browser, specialized tool, or a different program altogether. So you can't access it with a normal browser.
Okay, so what you just said is you can't use Chrome or Firefox or Brave, which I've never heard of till just this minute. Should we be using that? You're using Firefox, I think, and you're in security. Should I be using Firefox?
Oh, yeah. I think Firefox is a great browser to use. The Mozilla Foundation is kind of a privacy-first organization. Brave is a modified version of Chrome that's more privacy-centric. And that's honestly one of the reasons a lot of people use the dark web altogether is because of privacy concerns. And their privacy concerns are incredibly valid, especially when you consider the information that browsers are giving up about you. So that's why I like to, and this can be a whole different podcast, but like to use kind of more privacy-centric browsers like Firefox, like Brave, some other ones out there that don't give up as much information about you.
So, okay, I actually love the privacy tips while we're doing this, because when we get into the dark web, we're going to talk about what's living there. But I've gotten much more concerned about privacy, not just from what's collected by search engines, but then whatever's collected or indexed is making me more vulnerable, my privacy, my data. So, okay, you like Firefox, you like Brave, which is a subset of Chrome, sounds like. And the version of that you need to get to the dark web is Tor, T-O-R.
Yes. So that's to get to the kind of the most popular dark web, right? So there's, I guess, four or five different dark nets at this point, right? And collectively, they form the dark web. There's one called Freenet, I2P, LokiNet, and then there's Tor, which is like the most popular one. So most people, when they say, I'm searching the dark web, they mean to say they're searching Tor. But there are all these other platforms, and Tor is the most popular one. It has the most number of users, most number of content. I mean, there's a reason most people use it. And it's the easiest to use, easiest to configure, the easiest to access. And people want to use it because it has the most users. So that is the most popular one.
Okay, so that's the most popular dark net of the dark web.
Correct.
Okay, so I think the dark web has a PR problem. I mean, it's not helpful that it's called the dark web, and also it's perceived to be sort of rife with illicit activities. But I think it's worth talking through, because you spend a lot of time in that space, the sort of positive things that it can be used for and why people might find themselves there. And also maybe just technically, like my understanding is essentially Tor like jumbles your searches and sends them all around, and they're just hard to trace what you're spelunking around for.
So, I mean, the main reason that people are attracted to the dark web in general is the promise of privacy and anonymity. And I mean, that's why it was created in the first place. I think Tor was created in the 90s by the Naval Research Intelligence to basically mask naval intelligence officers who wanted to do things privately, as they wanted to do if you're an intelligence officer. So a lot of people were drawn to that promise in the beginning. And that continues to this day. And it doesn't have to be for bad. It can be for good as well, right? The idea is when you make a request to a website, and this is part of the reason why Tor is slow. That's one of the big problems and why a lot of people don't use it, is because it's pretty slow. And the reason it's slow is because essentially you have to make three or four different hops before you can get your content. So what happens is when you make a request, you're basically making that request to what's called an entry node. So this is kind of a machine, and this is all decentralized. There's not one central repository of machines that have this data. Anyone can volunteer to set up a node within the Tor network. So you make a request to this entry node. And this entry node will know who's making the request. So they'll know your IP address, And they'll know where eventually you want to end up, right? If you're trying to go to, let's say, the dark web version of the BBC, because the BBC News has a dark web mirror, you're saying, I want to search, you know, go to the BBC News. So you first kind of, you ask that first entry node, I want to go there. So that entry node then talks to another node, kind of like in the middle, and that middle node does not know your original IP address. All they know is where you want to end up, right? And then that goes to an exit node. Same idea. That exit node knows nothing about you whatsoever. They don't know the second jump. They don't know the first jump. All they know is where you want to end up. And then eventually that exit node will go to that BBC News website. And then you'll return the content. I hear people ask like, oh, well, so it's basically kind of hiding your IP address like a VPN. It's like, yes and no, right? Because with this Tor network, you're going through a decentralized network. So the middle node doesn't have any idea what's going on. Only the first node does. Whereas in a VPN, you have this centralized system where all it's doing is obscuring your IP address, but that's it. Like you're talking to one server, right? And it's usually like the big ones are NordVPN. That's a really big one. Nord will see your request. They know who's making the request. They know exactly what you want, because then they're going to return that content to you. It's very, very, very centralized, and they know everything about you. They see everything about you. So that's not something you would want to do if you're very interested in being super private. The VPN is not going to cut it. You would need to use something like Tor or these other darknets.
So the VPN is basically just obscuring your IP address sort of superficially or for the end website, but they have everything. So if Nord gets like, I don't know, say a subpoena, they could easily just be like, oh, this is what this person was doing.
Yeah, they will know everything. And a lot of them will say, oh, we don't do logs, we don't do anything. But like, how well do you really know these VPN providers? Like a lot of these are in odd jurisdictions. If they get requests from law enforcement or from government, right? A lot of people want to be private, not to do illegal things, but to maybe get around government censorship or to contact a journalist as part of a whistleblower thing. And that VPN provider could just as well tell that government, tell that company, hey, this IP address, which is inside your company or is associated with one of your employees or whatever, is trying to do this. Let's block it. Let's stop it. Let me share that information with you. Whereas with Tor, you don't have that issue because, like I said, you're going through these three different nodes with varying levels of anonymity where one doesn't know what the other is doing and none of them know who you are except for that entry node, which doesn't become an issue.
I remember during the Arab Spring, that's when I first started hearing about Tor and sort of these autocratic states, and maybe you were organizing protests or say you live in China and you want to freely search, you would use something like Tor, which is like a positive use case, is to avoid government censorship.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So it's not going to let governments know what you're searching for. It's like, so if you go on to a Tor website and it's whatever kind of search you don't want the government to know you're doing, like you don't want to search it. Or if you want free and uncensored access to news, you can go to Tor. Like a lot of repressive governments will censor BBC. They'll censor the New York Times. They'll censor like news organizations like ProPublica. These organizations realize that they all have a dark web mirror. They all have that ability for people to learn, to understand what's going on in the world without having the government censor that. Social media is notorious for tracking, et cetera. There are dark web social media platforms where you can go on and communicate freely with other people. Twitter and Facebook had, I don't know if they're still up, but you know, they had dark web mirrors for the longest time for that same reason, because you could share more freely there. So there's a lot of good. I mean, what draws these kind of people to the dark web is the same thing that draws bad people to the dark web as well. So there's both. But I mean, the surface web too. Surface web's not all nice, right? The deep web's not all nice. There's a lot of bad stuff that goes on there. In fact, like some of the biggest hacker sites are not on the dark web. They're on the deep web. You can access them today with your browser.
Interesting. Okay, so I want to talk about the bad guys. But just to go back really quickly. So when you first said that the BBC had a dark web mirror, I've never heard that in my life. But it makes sense because, and you said ProPublica, which I love ProPublica. So basically, these news sites are trying to make it available for people in potentially autocratic regimes to freely read the news. So they are taking the time to create a mirror in this space. I never heard that before just now.
These mirrors are essentially replicas of their surface web clear net sites that are just available on the dark web because they want people to access it. Same way they'll have, like the CIA has a dark website because, you know, they want anonymous tips. you know, different regulatory organizations will have kind of like little dark web drops so that you can anonymously make a complaint or let people know about corruption or whatever it is. There's a lot of good that comes from anonymity.
Okay. So then let's talk about the bad guys and what you do for a living.
Sure.
Okay. What do you do for a living?
So yeah, I am a managing director and head of the cyber practice at Prescient, which is a consulting firm in the US. So within the cyber practice, we do a lot of deep and dark web intelligence. So that includes doing assessments on individuals and companies and helping them know what their dark web exposure is. Because, you know, if we mentioned earlier, a lot of it is unindexed. So it's kind of like flying blind. Like you don't know what is being said out there unless you have something or someone collecting information from there. So we do a lot of that kind of work. We do a lot of the kind of typical incident response, digital forensics. I do a lot of online footprinting. And then actually recently co-founded a company called District 4 Labs that is only about dark web data. So there it's just identifying compromised PII, personally identifying information on the dark web from these hacked databases, from these big scrapes that happen, from weird little dark web databases that hackers trade back and forth, and kind of using that data for good to help investigators, to help law enforcement, corporate security, to track down bad guys, to identify who's behind certain threats, to help identify someone's online footprint.
Yeah. So I think this is really interesting. You said investigations and sometimes you'll have famous people or high net worth people who have no idea what's going on. But obviously there's money to be made on the dark web, mm-hmm. sort of trading their information or trying to access things or I guess hack them. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's a crazy amount of data like in the deep and dark web in these databases. And it's hard. You just don't know what's out there. Like everybody has probably gotten notifications in the mail or email saying, hey, you're part of this breach. You're part of this, part of that, et cetera. But it's hard to know, A, whether that data ever actually surfaced on the dark web. So you don't know. And then B, there's thousands of other little websites, some companies that you never get these notifications for that you're part of this data. And a threat actor can get a really good understanding of who you are by looking at this data, right? So like, one breach might have your email address and name. Another breach might have that same email address and your license plate number and your phone number. Another breach might have a list of all the financial transactions you've done over the last year, have bank account numbers. And without knowing that, you can't properly defend yourself against that. Or we do a lot of work for high net worth individuals, and they do everything possible to disassociate themselves from an address, right? They'll put it in the name of an LLC when they buy the house. They'll send packages to a PO box. They do all those things. But one time they accidentally sent their Drizzly order to their house and Drizzly got breached. And now the threat actor knows where they live and that's where they get deliveries. So there's just so much out there. And a lot of it is on the surface web. A lot of it's on the deep web, a lot of it's on the dark web. But until you kind of get that full picture, well, you need to be able to explore all three to get that full picture. Otherwise, you're only getting a part of it.
Yeah. And the average person, I mean, you can search on Google to see, you know, what's on the surface web. But even then, it's hard to take it down. But knowing everything that's out there. Also, by the way, for those who don't use it, Drizzly is booze that's delivered, which is why I think actually that's probably how they make mistakes. Like, put in their address for their on-demand booze. So let's back up just a little bit because I'd love to hear how you're thinking about trends across the dark web. So I know people probably have heard of the Silk Road and have like the gist of it. And I know it's 10 years old, but I think it's worth talking about what that was like and then sort of what the dark web looks like now when we're talking about illicit activity and people trying to intentionally obfuscate criminal actions on the dark web.
There is some nice parts of the dark web, right? There are people are reading the news, they're sharing cat pictures, et cetera. But I'd say probably, I don't know, like 40, 50% has bad stuff on there, right? Illicit material. And that's everything from hackers discussing how to hack, sharing exploits, sharing data from different breaches, maybe selling illegal material, whether it's drugs or selling exploits, selling data. They also offer services, right? Bad services. And that's out there. And the reason why people are on the dark net, as opposed to selling these services on the surface web or even the deep web, is because of that anonymity that they can kind of get. A lot of these threat actors will sell things on the dark web because, you know, they feel comfortable selling items there and they want their customers, so quote unquote, to feel comfortable because it's shrouded in this privacy. And one of the biggest ones, one of the first ones, really like kind of modern dark web markets was the Silk Road. And that was starting about 2011, mid-2011. It lasted for a couple of years. And it was kind of an interesting concept. Like there, they were selling all these illegal drugs. They were had sort of different services, like murder for hire, even like all like the really crazy stuff you hear about the dark web. When you think about dark web, that's the Silk Road. That was happening there.
And they were really doing that. So, I mean, I guess I think of it a little bit like an urban legend, but really hitmen were on the Silk Road.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I think the founder, Ross Ulbricht of Silk Road, he actually, I think, spent like, $500,000 hiring hitmen to kill people. They never actually went through with it. But, you know, that was a thing because, you know, it's also criminals, right? Like you can say you're going to do something and you don't always have to do it, right? It was not the most honored thing. I mean, that was one of the things he was trying to do later on was establish more of an escrow kind of system where you can kind of have more fidelity in the process. At the end of the day, it's criminals selling to criminals a lot of the time. I think in 2013, FBI finally caught up to him. I think actually most of the IRS helped a lot with the investigation and was able to put him away. But you know, as soon as that was put away, I think different administrators of the Silk Road started their own market, right? And since then, dozens of other markets have sprung up and closed down, usually by law enforcement.
So one thing that when I was sort of prepping for this episode, I ended up listening to this really well done podcast called Hunting Warhead, which is about child sexual abuse imagery on the dark web. We'll actually put a link to it in the notes because I think it's worth a listen. They talked about how it's exploding on the dark web access to these materials because it's like the only place that they feel that they can be. And then it's sort of this cat and mouse game with law enforcement. I was surprised when you just said 40 to 50% is sort of illicit activity. That's lower than I thought, but I also didn't realize like all these news sites and everything are on the dark web. And I guess if you go through the population of countries where people might be in regimes where they need to search, that's actually a decent amount of it. But is that a trend that people are seeing, that it's like child sexual abuse imagery versus drugs, or are there trends, or does anybody know? Can you really even know?
Yeah, you can definitely know, because while there's no Google indexing the dark web, there are other companies kind of indexing and collecting data from the dark web. We personally do a lot of it as well, just kind of scraping different forums, extracting information from forums, from different messaging platforms, from different marketplaces to kind of see what is trending, right? Like especially marketplaces are pretty easy, right? Because they have different categories. They'll have data, drugs, images, etc. So you can kind of get a sense of what's more, I guess, in demand. But there's also messaging platforms. And that's, I guess, technically would be kind of more of the deep web. The messaging platforms like Telegram, which you know, might have heard of, or Signal or Skype to kind of go back, or WhatsApp. These are platforms where you can create groups around similar or shared interests. So there are a lot of hacking groups that have Telegram channels. There's also child abuse where they share illicit images of children on Telegram. So it's not only happening on the dark web. I think sometimes it even happens on Facebook, like in like closed groups, because they think it's closed and no one can see. Like it's insane. And the problem, or one of the things with the dark net, is there is a barrier to entry, right? You have to know how to access it.
Yeah, that's actually what one of the things that was discussed in this podcast was, that people running these horrific sites would do the same thing just the average person does, which is reuse their usernames. And so once they could identify them on the dark web, they just found them on Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the interesting things, like, and that's why a lot of people, for example, use VPNs, right? Because they think if I'm not sharing my IP address, I can't be tracked. But the interesting thing is, like, over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, like, IP address has become less of a relevant issue. There's much, much, much better ways to track you online. Cookies, browser fingerprinting. These give you a much better sense of who you are, what you're doing, than an IP address ever can. But because people have this sense like, oh, they don't see my IP address because then I'm good. That's not how it works. I mean, every time you visit a website, your browser is giving a lot of information about you. It's letting you know, like, your screen resolution, maybe plugins that you have installed, fonts that you have installed, different services you might have used. And individually, doesn't mean a lot, right? Like, oh, Mateo has his monitor is set to this. The plugins he has on his browser are this. The fonts he has installed are this. like, doesn't mean anything, but everything combined together is incredibly unique. And you can basically fingerprint someone like, oh, that is Matteo Tomasini. And here he is visiting this website again. He's using a completely different IP address because he's using a VPN. He thinks he's smart, but I know it's him because he has the same exact configuration and everything. And that's why one of the other things that these darknet browsers do is they eliminate that. They don't let, you know, JavaScript run. They don't allow requests from cookies, things like that.
That creates a lot of friction, which is why a lot of people are still doing things on surface web and the deep web.
These cookies that they're not just tracking you on one website, they're tracking you from website to website to website so they can see where you have an account, right? Because they see you logged into Facebook. So now, you know, that company that you're buying a sync from knows you have a Facebook account. So now they're going to target you on Facebook. Browser fingerprint is really, really, really unique. So yeah, helps you kind of track someone.
Okay, so that's how we're being tracked. I do want to talk just quickly at the end about any tips you have for privacy. But before we do that, I recently read an article that AI is being used, I think, by folks in South Korea to sort of scan the dark web or try to use AI to come up, kind of what you were talking about. You guys can go through and look at like drugs are for sale and this is for sale, but they're trying to figure out what's on the dark web. Do you think that's a thing? What is sort of your assessment of it?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. I mean, so with the whole ChatGPT thing, like, and creating these large language models to help create conversational bots and to help answer questions, et cetera. So the whole idea is you need to first train it on a data set, right? So a ChatGPT and Bard, Google saying, like, they're trained on, so Google would be on their website, maybe on like their Quora and ask questions, like whatever it is, try and get a sense of how people talk, how people should respond, and what information is out there, right? Based on all these billions of pages that they've indexed that have all this information. But, you know, on the dark web, it's a little different, right? Especially like kind of on the illicit side, right? People talk in slang, right? And kind of they're referring to different exploits in not natural English. Or they're using kind of a different vernacular. So these models have not been trained on the vernacular. So like they wouldn't be able to, you know, go on the dark web and understand this is what people are talking about because it, for all they know, it looks like they're talking a different language and they're not trained on that. So what these, I think, South Korean researchers did was basically train a large language model, kind of like another ChatGPT, only on the dark web. They basically crawled Tor, I think is the darknet that they used instead of any of the other ones, and basically looked, all right, this is what people are saying, this is how they're saying it, so they could better classify content on the dark web so that they could look at something like, oh, this is a new ransomware shame site, right? Where they want to out someone for being hacked and pressure them to pay the money. Or this is talking about some exploit for a company. So it's interesting in that it'll help potentially even automate ransomware negotiations with threat actors, maybe, who knows. But just the fact that it can kind of help classify things better is interesting. But at the end of the day, there's already a lot of tools that are already doing this, but it's just kind of like an interesting exercise, kind of like a thought exercise.
It is an interesting thought exercise. I hadn't thought about it, but if there are sort of code words that people use or a vernacular that they're using that isn't going to be in, I actually hadn't thought about ChatGPT using Quora, which is sort of maybe an indictment of why you get weird relationship advice on from ChatGPT. But I think that it's interesting and maybe we'll learn something from it. But to your point, there are people, including you, who are doing like really targeted investigations of things, which is different than having like a general assessment of what's happening.
Right. Yeah. I mean, with all these things, it's kind of garbage in, garbage out. Like if you trained it on a good data set and you trained it well, you're going to get good results. Prior models weren't based on the dark web. And unfortunately, they use weird language there. There's a lot of slang, a lot of kind of slang that they use that is just not obvious unless you've kind of been in the dark web for a while or unless you train classification or a large language model on that.
Yeah. It's super interesting. Okay, so last thing, which is not exactly the topic of this, but you have some thoughts on, is just basic cyber hygiene. So I use Signal, which a lot of people in Washington, D.C. use because that's how you talk to reporters, because it's encrypted. In D.C., people don't tend to use Telegram because I think it's owned by Russian nationals. I'm not sure if that's even true, but nobody here uses it. They use Signal.
Yeah, no, that's the preferred messaging platform. Yeah, Telegram is a private company. The source code isn't laid bare, whereas Signal is something that's vetted by a large community. So that's what I use more than Telegram, more than WhatsApp. If I want to do secure communications, even just talking with friends, and I just don't want to deal with iMessage or whatever, I'll use Signal.
Okay. And then I do use NordVPN, although you've just educated me on how that's sort of a false sense of privacy when you get down to it. Is there anything else you use or any other tip you have for people?
Just understanding that by hiding your IP address, you're not hiding who you are, because there's browser fingerprinting, there's cookies, et cetera. And understanding that just because you're hiding IP address doesn't mean you can do all sorts of illegal stuff. Not that you are, but some people think, oh, they don't know who my IP address is, so I'm going to go now post all these threats on Twitter, or I'll do all this crazy stuff, when law enforcement could just as easily get a subpoena and go to Nord and get your logs. Or this has happened with 6 or 7 really, really large VPN providers. They will get hacked.
This is what I always think with a VPN, because it's got access to every. First of all, I don't even know why I have a VPN, to your point. I'm not really doing anything interesting. I'm definitely not doing anything interesting or illegal, but I do have a VPN.
Yeah. It's even if you're not doing interesting or illegal, like I still use a VPN for home browsing. So I think it's one step more of obfuscation. I understand that it's not everything. I understand that it's not concealing my identity 100%. I understand that this VPN is probably keeping logs on what my actual IP address is and maybe what the websites I'm visiting are, but it's one step better. It's better than not having the VPN.
Right. So it's another step, and it's a step, I mean, at least in my experience, it doesn't slow anything down, really. I think there is definitely, in general, just the average person is more privacy conscious than we used to be. I certainly am.
Yeah.
Even if it's just sort of on principle that I want to be more privacy conscious.
Yeah. I think the most important thing is to be able to make that decision yourself, is to understand, if I use this VPN or if I don't use this VPN, this is what people will have access to. Or if I accept this cookie or I turn on JavaScript while I'm browsing, this is what will happen. And then kind of make an informed choice from there, right? A lot of people don't know that when you accept certain cookies, or when you don't even have a choice, they're on there, like they're loaded by default, that cookie is tracking you, not just on that website, but across 30 different sites. They don't realize that when they're basically loading a website, that website will know everything about their device, and that they can then track them even without a cookie across the internet. So it's just kind of like, okay, I understand that this is the case. Do I care? No. Do I care? Yes. Okay. Then in that case, you know what? Let me download this other browser that doesn't give my information away, or let me disable JavaScript across every website, so I have to, by default, not be tracked. So as long as you're just educated on what the repercussions of certain actions are, that's fine. And if you accept them, you accept them. But I think the hard part is a lot of people just don't know. So they just kind of will blindly visit websites, click on things, allow location, do this without understanding what the repercussions of that are.
So that's a perfect place to end, because you've just spent some time explaining to all of us what the repercussions of some of that are. And I really appreciate you explaining the deep web versus the dark web and what a dark net is, because I sort of had the gist of it, but I didn't totally understand. So thank you so much, Matteo, for taking the time.
Of course, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Next week, I'm stoked to talk about the space race with reporter and writer Ashley Vance. He's the author of When the Heavens Went on Sale, which is his latest book, and it's all about the capitalists who are monetizing low Earth orbit. His book is written in a fun storytelling style, and we talk about the misfits and geniuses who are staking a claim in this final frontier.